practice. And then what I'd really like to do is have an open discussion. I think we'll just leave it open rather than do breakout rooms. Hopefully it won't get too cacophonous and crazy to do it that way. But I'd really be interested to hear what all of you do in your practice. So I will apologize in advance for I was telling my group in the breakout room that I'm fighting a little bit of a sinus congestion issue. So it's hit and miss whether my sinuses decide to cooperate today or if they're going to close up on me entirely and say, you don't get to say your M's and N's today. So, and I guess that actually worked. So far, so good. I can say the letter N. All right, we're good. So I also want to thank Domio for the opportunity to speak to everybody today. So just for those of you who don't know me, just a real brief history. I've been the Bright Ways Zen for about a year and a half, I think it was. I first walked into a Just Sitting. I believe Bruce and Mark were probably there. Maybe Jim was there too. So it was nice to see some of those faces. My very first visit to the Zendo. And I took Jukai last May as well. Prior to coming to Bright Way, I practiced with no rank Zendo under Rinzon Pachovnik Osho in the Rinzai Zen tradition. Prior to that, I spent some time at Portland Friends of the Dhamma, also here in Portland, practicing in the Theravada Thai Forest tradition of Ajahn Chah. Before that, for a couple of decades in my adult life, didn't really have a spiritual practice. As a child, my dad was actually an Assemblies of God minister. So very evangelical upbringing. He left the ministry when I was about 11, and we started attending a conservative Baptist church at that time. So early on, kind of very evangelical mindset. So when I went away to college at age 17, I pretty much ditched the whole thing and had nothing for many years until I found this practice. And so like some of you, I'm sure, those of you who are also fellow converts, if you will, to Buddhism. I know very few people in the United States who were born into it, but like some of you, I came to practice in a time of crisis, time of transformation, a lot of personal self-introspection, a period of time where I was really kind of tearing everything down and looking at it to say what works and what doesn't, what's healthy and what's not, what's beneficial to myself and others, and what's harmful to myself and others. And really trying to rebuild some semblance of self, if you will, that that worked, more better than maybe things that I had tried in the past. So when I came across Dogen's phrase, I believe it's in Fukan Zazengi, I always get all the Dogen stuff mixed up. The idea that we should take the backward step that turns the light around, that illuminates the self. That's a very, very key teaching for me, because I really feel like I was taking a backward step of sorts without even knowing what I was doing when I came to the practice. So having come to the practice in that frame of mind, I really feel a strong obligation to bring the practice to bear on everyday life. Otherwise, I would kind of feel like I was wasting it. I was wasting my time and wasting effort. I don't want to be one of those people that their spiritual practices over here, like, well, I sit in Zazen and I chant and I do all that, and then go back to daily life and kind of forget all of it and not bring any of it to bear on how I actually comport myself with my coworkers and my family, my wife and my kids, or my extended family. I've encountered a lot of that in the past with the upbringing and especially in the evangelical side, and then some of the family and friends over the years. And I definitely saw good examples of that where it's like, well, I go to church on Sunday and every other day of the week, I'm a total sinner. So I didn't want to fall into that trap. So I really, for me personally, I really take the practice seriously as an element of my everyday life. So some of you may know I'm in addition to my day job teaching, I'm also a professional musician, have been for quite a while. And so my approach to this practice is kind of like, I like to equate it to musical practice to a degree. So lately I'm a trumpet player by training, but I also play piano, and I'm actually working on a new album. And so I've been practicing piano a lot, because piano is the dominant instrument. And I write songs, and I would practice and practice every day. And so I look at it like okay, I'm sitting down at the piano to practice and I play and, oh, I made a mistake. Okay, back up, look at it. What do I need to do differently? How do I need to approach this? Okay, try it again. Keep doing it again. Oh, whoop, another mistake. Let's back up, try it again. And then finally, until I get that muscle memory and mental memory down to where I can actually do it. And all of it in preparation, in my case at least, for going into a recording studio and needing to play it perfectly because I'm paying the dude $85 an hour to be there, you know. So it's very important that I get it right. So I kind of equate this practice to that. Like I'm sitting at my piano and I'm practicing and I'm practicing and I'm practicing and practicing so that I can go into the studio and do it right. And so I look at Zazen and chanting and bowing and Sangha practice and all that as practicing to practice the practice, if that makes sense, right? Practicing to be practicing the practice in real practice. go back a couple levels there. But for me, it's like, okay, I'm sitting here, Zazen, I'm chanting and bowing, and I'm, you know, watching thoughts as they come and go and, you know, seeing where I'm stuck, seeing where I'm not stuck. And then I hopefully can step off the cushion and go into daily life and keep that in mind. Like, oh yeah, I tend to get stuck here. You know, I have these negative thoughts, I have these positive thoughts. So how can I go into daily life and avoid that type of aversion and that type of desire, you know, the two and three poisons, right? How can I go into daily life and stay balanced with those? Like I try to stay balanced with them on the cushion. So to that end, bringing the practice into daily life, I was very, very excited when I first started practicing at Brightway to see Domyo's 9 fields of Zen practice, and particularly the practice of Myoho under skillful action. And so for those of you who have done the 9 fields practice are very familiar with this, but I just want to read the description to everybody in the event that maybe you haven't seen it. This is available on the website, by the way. I don't know exactly where, but if you look up 9 fields, you'll find it there. Myoho is acting in accord with the Dharma in everyday activities. Myoho means in accord with Myo, the Dharma, Ho. In Zen, Myoho practice refers specifically to the ways we act in accord with the Dharma in every aspect of our lives. There is no activity too mundane to do with care, and nothing we encounter is unworthy of our attention and respect. Zen asks us to be ordained into our lives, quote unquote, completely and utterly embracing who and what and where we are, giving up all regret, resentment, and comparison, and seeing our path of practice as sacred work. We cultivate gratitude, respect, and appreciation, and vow to live by choice instead of on autopilot. So to me, it's very clear. It's like, okay, how can I, when I'm engaged in my everyday life, how can I bring these ideas to bear? How can I bring big mind to bear? You know, I'm trying to cultivate big mind when I'm sitting on the cushion in Zazen posture, but how can I bring that big mind into talking to my wife and playing with my kids and doing the dishes and doing the laundry and scooping the cat box and all that type of thing? Good. So I carry around my own little toolkit of techniques, if you will, little tools that I want to share. And then I'd really love to hear what's in your toolkit so that maybe I can add. I hear something like, oh, that sounds great. I can add that to mine as well. And then hopefully everybody can benefit from hearing everybody else's tools that are in their toolkit. So for me, there are two foundational texts that kind of form the basis of my toolkit. Well, three, actually, if you count Domyo's 9 fields and that description of Myoho. But two texts that I've come across in my practice that really were profoundly impactful and things that I can actually carry around up here with me in even the most mundane of situations. The first is one of the writings in this book, The Gateless Barrier, also known as the Wu Men Guan or the Mu Meng Kon. This particular one from Zenkei Shibayana, they use this very frequently in the Rinzai tradition, which is where I first came across it. But obviously it's a very applicable to our life too. So the one that really stuck out to me that I want to just share with you briefly is case 19 of the Mu Meng Kon called Ordinary Mind is Tao, or Ordinary Mind is the Way. And so I'll just read the koan to you really briefly. Master Joshu once asked Master Nansen, "What is Tao? What is the way?" Nansen answered, "Ordinary mind is the way. Ordinary mind is Tao." Joshu said, "Then should we direct ourselves towards it or not?" Nansen said, "If you try to direct yourself towards it, you go away from it." Joshu continued, "If we do not try, how can we know that it is the way? How can we know that it is the Tao?" Nansen replied, "The way does not belong to knowing or to not knowing. Knowing is illusion, not knowing is blankness. If you really attain to Tao of no doubt, it is like the great void, so vast and boundless. How then can there be right and wrong in the Tao?" At these words, Joshu was suddenly enlightened. And then the other text that I really like, and then I'm going to encapsulate how those affect my practice. The other text I really like is this one here, the verses on faith mind, also known as the Sin Sin Ming. I've got Thomas Cleary's translation here of Sengchan's, the third Zen patriarch, his famous poem. And I love, like, this is my desert island book. If I had to be stranded on a desert island with only one text, this would be it right here. Very, very small, as you can see, very thin, relatively short poem, but it encapsulates the entirety of the practice. And it's the first two quatrains that I carry with me. And actually, I love so much that I actually end up reciting these first two lines to my kids when they're really, you know, they're demanding and want something. Like, I want some ice cream. They get this one when they say that. "The great way is not difficult for those not attached to preferences. When neither love nor hate arises, all is clear and undisguised. Separate by the smallest amount, however, and you are as far from it as heaven is from earth. If you wish to know the truth, hold to no opinions for or against anything. To set up what you like against what you dislike is the disease of the mind." And so for me, those two texts really get to this practice of Nyoho. They really support this idea of bringing the practice into everyday life. It's like, you know, what is the way? Like we always approach these with these big, grand, spiritual, transcendental thoughts and desires and everything, you know, like, what is this magnificent, ethereal, eternal, universal way of all things? It's just this. There's nothing to it. It's just your everyday life, you know. But that's not all there is to it. It's not just your everyday life. It's how you approach your everyday life. And so, okay, so if everyday life is the way, my mundane everyday washing dishes, playing with the kids, whatever, sweeping the floor, if that's the way, is that it? Well, no. It also takes approaching the way, approaching everyday life with a mind of equanimity, trying to put away the discriminating mind, trying to stop the picking and choosing, trying to not set up like against dislike, as the Sin Sin Ming says. And so if I can approach my everyday activities, day in and day out, every hour of the day, with this idea of not being attached to preferences, and when the bad things come, thank you for the lesson you're teaching me, bad thing, you know, I'm not going to try to push you away. And when the good things come, thank you for the lesson you're teaching me, good things, I appreciate you, I have gratitude for you, but I know you're not going to stick around forever. You know, to approach all of this in and out, up and down, day in and day out, with that mind of balance right in the middle, that's very, very profound to me. So those two texts together kind of form that continuity, for me at least, of everyday life is the way. And if I can approach it with not being attached to preferences, if I can approach it with an equanimous mind that doesn't set up like a dislike, that's where I'm really going to be practicing. You know, that's the true practice for me. I've got a list of a couple of different things that I want to share with you. And so just to kind of reiterate what I'm talking about here, that I think it's really important to learn how to, like, probably a clear example that everybody can relate to. I have to unload the dishwasher, and then load the dishwasher, and then I got to scoop the cat box, and then I got to, you know, got my little chores. But I'd really rather be watching this new show on Amazon Prime that I started getting into. Man, I'd really rather be sitting on the couch with my iPad and just watching this cool show. I don't want to do these things. So if I can bring big mind, equanimous mind, to bear on the dishwasher and the cat box and all the other stuff, and just be with it as it is and say, oh, this is what I'm doing right now. Yes, washing dishes and loading dishwasher, unloading dishwasher, scooping cat box, you know, sweeping floor. That I'll be much happier and much more at peace with life in general if I can do that, rather than thinking, oh, I really hate this, I don't want to be doing this, slamming things around just so I can, you know, get done with this. I just want to be done and I want to get to the couch. That if I can learn how to do that with the small stuff, then that's going to help me handle the big stuff, right? If I can bring big mind to something as mundane as washing dishes, will that help me? Will I be practicing to then bring big mind to something more serious? You know, an injury, sickness in my family. I've had to do this these last couple of weeks. My mom was very seriously ill and in the hospital and is still in the hospital right now. And went in 2 weeks ago, heart failure, kidney failure, all sorts of stuff. And so I've had to really bring this equanimous mind to bear on, you know, the fact that my mother might pass away. You know, she's out of the woods now, but, you know, a week and a half ago, 2 weeks ago, it was really touch and go. And I was very, very much had to bring these concepts to bear and actually try to use them to whatever degree I could. You know, certainly was more worried about that than I was about getting to the couch. But, you know, to what degree does knowing how to not sweat the small stuff, to use the, I don't know, some self-help book from years ago, not sweating the small stuff, how does that help me not sweat the big stuff too? Or at least handle the big stuff with more grace and ease than I do. So all of that leads up to, I've whittled it down to about four things that I think are kind of interesting. And for me, the best way to remember something and actually apply it is if it's really easy to remember. So a mnemonic device, some sort of imagery, a catchphrase or something that when I'm in the moment of, oh, I don't want to wash the dishes, oh, wait a minute, you know, something that could pop into my head in that moment. Was, oh, okay, great. Now I need to shift gears, right? So again, just practicing to practice the practice, right? So that's, I said zazen to practice, but now I've got to practice the practice when I'm needing to wash the dishes and I don't want to. That's when I actually have to practice the practice, right? So I'll give you these four things and hopefully they make sense to you. And then again, I'd like to open up discussion to hear what everybody else has in their toolkit. So these are my four major tools in my toolkit. The first one I call mindfulness of the miraculous mundane. Mindfulness of the miraculous mundane. And for me, it's the mnemonic device is the alliteration there, the three M's. Remember the three M's. And not the tape 3M, but the three M's. Mindfulness of the miraculous mundane. Which, of course, as we saw in the Gateless Barrier and the Sense of Ming and what we hear all around us in all of our Zen practice and every Dharma talk ever given and every Dharma book ever written, yeah, seeing things as they really are, particularly the things that we tend to take for granted and overlook. So this one is, this is a little bit different from the other three in that this one is actually more applicable to the quiet moments. There's actually another Zen story that I really enjoy that kind of illustrates this. This is a story from, it's actually a koan, another koan from The Hidden Lamp, which is a collection of koans that was published fairly recently, compiled by Florence Kaplow and Susan Moon, that are all koans that feature women. And of course, Florence and Susan are women themselves. And the commentaries to the koans are all done by female teachers, priests, and whatnot. I think even Chosen Bays from our own Great Vow here has a couple of commentaries in that book. So I'll just read you the koan because I think it's kind of a cute story that illustrates this mindfulness of the miraculous mundane. Magu Nongquan and another monk were on pilgrimage. Along the way, they met a woman who had a tea shop. The woman prepared a pot of tea and brought three cups. She said to them, "O monks, let those of you with miraculous powers drink tea." The three monks looked at each other and couldn't say a word. The woman said, "Watch this decrepit old woman show her miraculous powers." She picked up the cups, poured the tea, and walked out. And I love that story because that's very, the visual on that is just, I'd love to somebody to actually make a movie, like a little short film of that, because it would be really entertaining. And I can just picture these monks, like very, you know, esteemed, you know, probably just a little bit of pride in their practice and how, you know, how far along in their practice they were. And this, you know, humble little owner of a tea shop says, "Show me your miraculous powers." And all they can do is think about it in these grandiose transcendental terms of, oh, like if you read some of the early suttas, the early Buddhist texts that are used in the Theravadan tradition, they outline miraculous powers as like, you know, being able to walk through walls and you can dive into the earth and come back out and you can float up into the air. So I can picture these monks looking at each other like, can you float? I can't float. Can you go down? Can you walk through that wall? I can't do it. And they were mistaking this miraculous power for something transcendental and outside of their everyday life. So the old woman was actually more enlightened than they were because she realized that just the act of pouring tea is in and of itself a miraculous thing, like the miracle. Like think about the, you know, this collection of atoms called a human being with this arm and this collection of atoms called a cup that, wow, this cup is made out of earth and there's, you know, a pot full of earth and water and we're pouring this earth and water into this pot of earth. How amazing that is, you know. And so this mindfulness of the miracles of just the mundane things that we take for granted. This is something I know Thich Nhat Hanh emphasizes a lot in his teachings as well. That just a leaf falling from a tree is miraculous. If you really think about what is the leaf and what is the tree and what is the ground that the leaf falls on and how everything is contained in that, the sunshine and the earth and rainfall and the leaf is falling, it's going to become compost, it's going to go back and nourish the tree, and just all these amazing things that, you know, how many trees do we walk by or drive by every day? Do we really think about that? Do we really look at the tree and say, what an amazing thing? You know? So trying to have that mindfulness of everyday mundanities then helps us to not take them for granted and to really say, oh, wow, I'm drinking tea. How wonderful. Instead of just, oh, I got to get my caffeine fixed and get on to what else I want to be doing. So I really enjoy that one. So mindfulness of the miraculous mundane is my first one. And sometimes I'm up for zazen about 5:30 in the morning. You know, I do my little chores and then I'll sit. And sometimes I'm too tired to really just shikantaza, like I'm just going to go and fall right off the bench and fall asleep. So I'll sometimes do that with I have a little cup of coffee, you know, coffee mug. It's made from clay. Clay is made from earth. Wow, I wonder where was this earth pulled from and turned into clay and then fired into a mug? And the coffee, it's water and it's coffee beans. And the water was once rainfall, or it was a lake. It was vapor evaporating into the air. And the coffee beans grew on a tree. And the tree was taking moisture from the rain and sunshine and the earth taking nutrients up from the earth. Like, how amazing that is. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't, depending on how alert I am. But so that's one, mindfulness of the miraculous mundane. Number two, I call go straight by winding along. And this one is particularly helpful to me when I encounter difficulties or when I encounter obstacles, even if it's something as minor as, you know, I'm trying to make coffee and we're out of coffee. Now what do I do? And there's actually a little story I want to relate from this book by Shundo Ayama, the book called Zen Seeds. Shundo Ayama, there she is. She looks like a very, very wonderful person to spend some time with. Yeah. Very happy. She's a Soto Zen priest in Japan. And this is actually a very wonderful compilation, Zen Seeds, 60 Essential Buddhist Teachings on Effort, Gratitude, and Happiness by Shundo Ayama. I can put that in the chat if you want. But I sometimes will read this before I do my sit just to kind of get myself into that zone. But there's a wonderful story in here in one of the essays that where I got this go straight by winding along. Zen master Genshu Watanabe, in his last years, called to his bedside a monk who had recently become a disciple. The master asked, How can one go straight on a steep mountain road of 99 curves? When the young disciple replied, I don't know, he was told, walk straight by winding along. Walk straight by winding along. Go straight by winding along. And this is very helpful for me to call to mind in those difficult moments, because you know, you think about when you've got some kind of I'm on a mission, I've got a goal, I've got to get to the goal, you know, like we all have, whether it's work related or family related, or just, I have a goal of washing the dishes, right? We always want to get there straight away. Like, there's a goal. I want to get there as quickly and easily as possible. I want to take the highway at top speed and get to where I'm going. But how many times do we encounter some kind of obstacle, something that pulls us away from that in the moment, right? So in my household, you know, I really have to finish the chores in the kitchen. And then my daughter turns 4 next week. So here comes Anjali, like, Daddy, you want to play with me, you know, or something like that, right? Or she's, something's terribly, terribly wrong. One of her dolls, you know, like she can't get the dress back on the doll. You know, this is a major, major emergency, right? So if I really want to get to the goal as straight and as quickly as possible, and then I've got this obstacle, well, how do I handle the obstacle? How do I view the obstacle in terms of my end goal? And I love Zen Master Watanabe's analogy there, because you think about climbing a mountain as a metaphor for getting to your goal. It's like, well, yeah, oh, there's the summit. Boy, I would really like to get to that summit as quickly as possible. You know, like climbing Mount Everest or something, right? If you could just go boop, 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 and walk straight up the side of the mountain, that would be great, right? Get there in 20 minutes would be awesome, you know. But that's not how it really works, right? How do you get to the top of the mountain? Well, you have to wind along, right? You have to, you know, every mountain road from the bottom of the mountain to the top of the mountain either goes like this, zigzags back and forth, or it goes around the mountain and spirals up here. And so we want to get there by the most straight and direct path possible, but that's not usually how things work. So if I can go straight by winding along, like I'm getting to the goal, but yeah, okay, here's a detour. I got a little left turn. I got to make that. Oh, it looks like I'm backtracking. It looks like I'm going away from my goal. Oh, well, actually I'm not, right? It's just, this is the road that I have to follow to get to where I want to go. Right? So all of the little difficulties in life, and even some of the medium difficulties in life, I really try to view from that angle of, okay, I wanted things to be this way, but now they're like this. So I'm going to go this direction. I'm going to do this little detour and maybe I have to wind along to get where I'm going, but I'll get there eventually, or maybe I won't. And the new goal comes along, or a new destination comes along, and oh, okay, I'm going there instead. All right, here we go. You know, so I really love this mental image of going straight by winding along. All right, the third one. I'm trying to get through these fairly quickly. I don't want to run out of time here. I have a mindfulness mantra. This is very easy to understand. So if I get stuck, and I can feel a frustration, anxiety, like I really don't want to be doing this thing that I have to do. Big one for me is scooping the cat box. Got the litter box and I'm just shoveling little nuggets out of there, right? You know, and I'll use the mantra, there's no place else I'd rather be and nothing else I'd rather be doing. There's no place else I'd rather be and nothing else I'd rather be doing. There's no place else. And I'll repeat this and repeat this and repeat this and repeat this. And it works, right, in those moments, because it'll pull me out of that frustration momentarily and get me to that point of, oh, there's no place else I'd rather be and there's nothing else I'd rather be doing, because there is no place else I could be and nothing else I could be doing, because right here, I'm here, standing in my freezing cold garage at 5 o'clock in the morning and I'm shoveling cat poop, you know, like it's got to be done. This is the time to do it. This is the place to do it. Let's do it. You know? And so I also use this a lot. You know, standing in line is a good one, right? Or caught in slow traffic, right? There's no place else I'd rather be, nothing else I'd rather be doing. So it kind of ties along to this going straight by winding along, because sometimes in order to remind myself that I have to wind along to go straight, I have to use this mantra. There's no place else I'd rather be, nothing else I'd rather be doing. And then the last one I call chameleon or curmudgeon. Again, the alliteration and the rhyme there helps me to remember it. Chameleon or curmudgeon. And this is all about, who do I choose to be in this situation? I've got a difficult situation or something I'd rather not be doing, washing dishes, scooping cat poop, whatever, right? Do I choose to be the chameleon and just adapt and shift into this new mode? Okay, now I'm doing this. this is what has to be done, and just adapt to it. And like a chameleon changes its colors in order to blend in with the environment, do I change my attitude colors to blend in with the situation as it is in that moment? Or do I choose to be a curmudgeon and stick to the way I wanted things to be and not let go of those and then be really grumpy, right? Because here's the way I wanted things to be and here's how they really are. And the distance between those two is the amount to which I'm going to suffer if I choose to be the curmudgeon, right? If I hold really fast to, this is how I wanted things to be, but this is how they really are. No, there's going to be that tension. That is the degree to which I suffer. But if I choose to be the chameleon and adapt to that situation, tension goes away, frustration goes away, right? And there's a really, really excellent poem also in the same Zen Seeds book that I just absolutely love. This is by the Japanese poet Michio Amado, called Cleaning Rag. When I came back home on a rainy day, a cleaning rag was waiting for me in the entrance hall. I'm a cleaning rag, it said with a friendly look, though it hadn't wanted to become one. Until quite recently, it had been a shirt. It was as soft as my skin. Maybe in America or somewhere, it had been a cotton flower, smiling in the sun and wind. And so I just love the visual there of this, you know, cotton flower in a cotton field. Oh, I'm a cotton flower. What wonderful sunshine, what wonderful rain. And oh, wait a minute, I'm being picked. Okay, I'm being picked. All right, now I'm a cotton ball. Now I'm being spun into thread. Okay, I'm being spun into thread. And now I'm being woven into a shirt, or, you know, and now I'm a shirt. Yay, I'm a shirt. Oh, wait a minute, now I'm being turned into a cleaning dragon. So if at any point along the way that piece of cotton had decided to be the curmudgeon, like, no, I want to stay a cotton flower. I don't want to be a, you know, piece of thread. Don't weave me or don't spin me into a piece of thread. Don't make me into a shirt. Don't make me into a cleaning rag. If at any point it had resisted, how much worse would its life have been? But instead it adapted. So, no, here we go. Now I'm a t-shirt. Okay, now I'm no longer a t-shirt. Now I'm a cleaning rag. All right, here we go. You know, and to be able to just be present in that moment of, now I'm a cleaning rag, happy to be a cleaning rag, here we go, you know. And so I like to think of that too, like, am I a cleaning rag right now, or am I still trying to be a shirt? You know, again, to what degree am I deciding if I'm going to be able to adapt, or am I going to resist? And sometimes when I feel myself resisting, if I keep that in mind, I say, okay, you're resisting right now. See if you can adapt to the situation as it is, and just focus on that and be that. So, all right. Well, I apologize. That took far longer than I wanted it to. I have a tendency to ramble, as any of my students will tell you. But so I want to open up the discussion to everybody here and see if you have any tools in your toolbox that you would like to share with the group.
James, I just wanted to say, first of all, thank you, because I just thought that was such a wonderful talk. And I don't have those colorful mnemonics and tricks that you have. But nevertheless, I think you and I are of the same mind in terms of bringing the practice from the cushion into my everyday life. I'm a huge fan of Faith and Mind. In fact, its first two lines, I'm always saying to myself in my head, the way is not difficult as long as you do not pick and choose. And I was struck by the chameleon analogy. It brought me back to growing up in Florida, which I did do. And there we have these little teeny tiny lizards. That's what we called them. They're small and they're thin and they're generally bright green, but they do change color. And I was thinking, as you talked about your analogy, that they change color moment by moment. Every single moment, gradually that color changes. So there's a moment by moment element in that I really appreciate. As you were talking, I was looking at words. I apologize for that. But I looked up the word practice. And one of the definitions is to perform over and over. And I'm a big believer, just from my own life experiences and from my own limited experience with Zen, that I've got to try. And sometimes I miss that lesson. I remember conversations with Domyo over Shikantaza, and I was just, so you just want me to sit here and do nothing, right? I just sit here and I do nothing, right? Is that what you want? And I would inevitably get caught every single time. Well, you have to try a little bit. Well, then tell me to try. I mean, what are you telling me to do here? But I really appreciate the idea of doing over. I mean, that's the way I, in particular, learn. Everybody learns a different way. The last thing I'll say is, it's really a lesson in humility, this whole thing. I do metta every single day, no question. What I would like to do is do it every single morning, and I'm not quite there. But what's interesting is that even when I do it in the morning, one of the things I say, you know, in mind, there are four, I'm actually doing a loving kindness practice, and there are four things I say. And one of them is to be loving and kind to every person I encounter today. And then I immediately go down to the kitchen and see that things are not left the way they should have been left. And then I get, you know. So it is, you got to have a sense of humor. You got to be easy on yourself. Easy, but do it. You have to do it too. So thank you very much. It's a tough seat to be sitting in, I know. And I just really appreciate the thought you put into this.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Thank you, Jinryu. Very nice. Yeah, I think the thing that attracted me to Zen was that paradox, you know, or that seeming conflict between, wait, you want it this way, but you also want it this way? Like, those don't really go together. Right. And that's, you know, it's that space between them that is exactly where you need to be. So, yeah, thank you. Thanks for your thoughts. Anyone else?
James, this is Bruce. Yeah, I'll echo Jinryu's statement of thank you for your talk. I really enjoyed it. But it brought to mind a couple of things. First is the title of a book I read that's kind of like the Ordinary Mind book every day. It's called Everything is the Way. I don't remember who the author is, and I don't have the book in front of me, but it's an excellent book that talks about how everything you do in your life, like scooping the poop out of your cat box. She doesn't reference that specifically, anyway. And then there was a gatha that Thich Nhat Hanh wrote that's similar to what Jinryu just said. When he wakes up in the morning, he says, I wake up every morning with a smile on my face. I have 24 new hours ahead of me. I vow to look at all beings through the eyes of compassion. I try and remember to say that sometimes. Anyway, so thanks again. I really like your chat. So.
Thank you. Yeah, so thank you in the chat for the, that's a nice idea. I don't know if my cats would go through a self-cleaning box with that. You know, but that's the thing. It's like, I appreciate that. Sometimes my wife will say, wow, are you ever going to sit down and you keep doing chores? I'm like, no, I'm good with this because it's forcing me to practice. You know, it's one thing to your point, Bruce, to say, like, I'm going to be compassionate to all beings today, but then actually remember to do it when, you know, some dude is, you know, cuts you off in traffic or something like that. That can be a difficult thing sometimes. And thank you for the book reference. I'll definitely look that up. That's very good. Very good. All right. What else? Anyone?
Mark just put the name of the book and the author in chat. So if you want to, yeah. So everything thanks, Mark.
Thank you, Mark. Yeah, that's great.
James, I just have to say, I think you've helped me very much see how much of a curmudgeon I am simply because I've been attached to understanding what I'm doing. I'm terrified of not understanding something. And so if something doesn't make sense, I'm going to my teacher. But you said, and it's like this, and I'm in stress, and I got an ulcer at age 16 in high school.
Well, I'm sorry for your ulcer. I hope you're better now. To echo what I said before too, to Jinri, I think the thing that attracted me to Zen was that there's understanding and then there's not understanding. And that those are kind of almost, the not understanding is almost more important than if you do understand, then you've kind of lost it, right? And so that getting ourselves out of that small mind, getting ourselves out of that everyday habitual, like I've got to know and I've got to do and I've got to have a list and I've got to get there and I've got to go there and I've got to do that, you know, and it's got to have meaning. And then Zen kind of just says, forget all that, just sit. You know, I love that seeming paradox between the two and just that sitting right in between what we understand and what we don't understand. Thank you. I appreciate that. Thank you.
James, I just love your casual approach. You weren't uptight. You were so, you know, you delivered it beautifully. I just wanted to add that your wife is one lucky woman. She's got you washing the dishes and cleaning the cat litter.
She does. She does a lot of things too. She's going to hear this talk and be like, now wait a minute. You don't do everything. Thank you, Joan.
Yeah. Hi, James. It's Paulette.
Hi, Paulette.
You had three that you mentioned. I thought you had four that you wanted to share with us.
Sure. Mindfulness of the miraculous mundane. So I told the story about the miraculous power of pouring tea, and then go straight by winding along, so having to zigzag to get to the summit. Then my mindfulness mantra, which is there's no place else I'd rather be and nothing else I'd rather be doing. And then the fourth one was chameleon or curmudgeon.
Oh, got it. Thank you.
May I say something?
Please do.
Okay, I can't see who all is raising their hand. Thank you for this. This is really, really inspiring. Like you, I'm a parent, a working parent, very, very busy. And you mentioned your students, and maybe you're a teacher, because I'm a teacher. Okay. So I can relate on a lot of different areas. One thing that I find really heartening that I would like to share is just having a child, I think, often brings us back into the miraculous mundane. And that's something that I've really appreciated for my 5-year-old. So, like, when I'm caught up in work and the craziness and, you know, thinking about the next thing I have to do, the next email I have to respond to, the next lecture I have to give, like, she somehow, like, points out the simplest, silliest little thing. And it all makes sense.
Yeah.
Suddenly. And the little anecdote I wanted to share is, like, when we first had lockdown here in the UK a year ago, like, we couldn't really go anywhere. So it's like we have this parking lot in the apartment building that I live in. And it's not very beautiful, but there are some plants and there's like a little like sickly looking tree. And actually, those weeks that we were in lockdown were sometimes some of the most precious, because I'd go out there with my daughter and we'd start to notice like, you know, like moss growing out of like the brick and ladybugs crawling on the, and, you know, ants and all of these little like just signs of life that you don't notice normally because you just kind of walk by it every day. So we'd start to notice the little things and talk about those things. And now, like anywhere we go, it's like we pick up on all these little details, and she's better at it than I am. So she just brings me right back into it, and she'll just pick up on all these beautiful details. And so for me, that's been, I think, a saving grace on many, many days. But I don't think you necessarily need a five-year-old to appreciate those things, to appreciate the mundane.
Everybody go out and get a five-year-old and make your Zen practice and that much better. Yeah, perfect.
Yeah, exactly. But I love your kind of your mantras and your little reminders. They're brilliant. I'll have to adopt some of that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, we walked at the nature park yesterday, and my daughter turns 4 next week, and we're walking along, and she goes, "Look at that tree. I love you, tree." Like, that's it right there. Why can't I be more like that?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Newborn all over again.
Crazy. It's crazy. Thank you.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, I need so much help with that stuff too that I even got it. I can't really twist my arm well enough for you to see it, but I've got Dongshan's "Just This" tattooed on my forearm. Like, if nothing else, if I can just look at my arm, it's like, yes, just this, just this. okay, good. Here I go. You know, that's a pretty extreme way of trying to remind yourself to keep the practice in mind. But I had space on my arm, so why not? You know. Anything else? Thank you. Okay, well. As a teacher and, you know, practicing Zen, I've gotten more and more used to uncomfortable silences. So they're not really uncomfortable anymore, but I don't want to make anyone else feel like, gotta say something.
Do you have to talk to the circles?
The circles, yeah, right.
Like, you know, none of the students want to show themselves, so I'm talking to circles all day long.
See, I mandate cameras on. You got to have your camera on. That's the only way I can make sure you haven't fallen asleep on.
Good policy.
Of course, I didn't scroll through this to make sure you never fell asleep today, but well. All right. Well, Bob, I'll pass it back to you, I guess, as the official Zoom guy. I'm not sure how we close out today.
Okay, well, that's fine. Thank you very much, James. It's been really something. Yes, wonderful. So I'm going to go ahead and unmute everybody so everybody can say goodbye and give it a few seconds and we'll let's see. I can't unmute people. I can mute people, but I can't unmute them. So if you'd like to unmute yourself to say goodbye, then do so, and I'll close it after everybody's gone.
Have a lovely day.
All right, lovely day. Goodbye.
All right, thank you, everyone.
Thanks, everyone. Thank you, James.
Thank you.
Thanks, James and Bob.
Thank you, James.
Thank you.
Bye, everyone.
Gotcha.
Bye, Bob.